Today is Tuesday, August 29th, 2006. I am Sandy Fahler, an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I am interviewing Joe Handelsman, Howard Hughes Medical Institute Professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison Plant Pathology Department. She is also one of the founders and leaders of Wisely, Women in Science and Engineering Leadership Institute, and director of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute Program for Scientific Teaching. In addition, she is co-director of the National Academy's Summer Institute for Undergraduate Education in Biology. Hello.
Hi.
We're going to start this interview by asking you to go back to your early life, where and when you were born, where you went to elementary school, high school, if you would talk about your family, what your parents did, if you have any brothers and sisters, any people in your life, early life, that influenced you in your future education and career?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was born and grew up in and around New York City, and probably one of the most important activities I had as a kid that shaped my ultimate interest in science was driving out on Long Island to the tip of Long Island where there were these great beaches. My family used to visit them every year. And we would pass, at that time Long Island had a lot of agriculture, so we would pass these corn rows. And I thought it was absolutely fascinating that when you look straight down a corn row, you can see all the way down. And then when you just passed it, you can't see down that row. And for some reason, the geometry of that just, I thought was the coolest thing in the world. And so I used to sit in the car glued to the window watching the cornrows go by in our summer vacation trips. And then I decided when I got to high school that I wanted to work in agriculture. And that came in part from my love of looking down cornrows. But also I had a really great biology teacher in 10th grade. And he not only taught biology in a fabulous way, but he would cut things out of the newspaper or bring me stories or give me extra books and things to read about biology. And one of the articles that he gave me was an article from the New York Times about the development of the high lysine corn. It was developed jointly between a research center in Mexico and Oliver Nelson, who was a corn geneticist here at the University of Wisconsin. And that high lysine corn had a better nutritional balance of amino acids and was, you know, a major breakthrough in plant breeding for feeding the world. And that's what I decided I wanted to do. I wanted to feed the world. So I had that New York Times article posted over my desk through many, many moves from New York City to Cornell, where I was an undergraduate, and then even to out here. I think I had it for about 10 years. And only after I moved out here and met Oliver Nelson, actually he was the first professor I had in graduate school in Madison, did I make the connection that this article that had been such a stimulating as you know source of inspiration for me actually had a connection to where I decided to go to graduate school. So it was just sort of coming around in a funny way. But of course, all roads lead to Madison, so I really shouldn't have been surprised by that.
Now, what did your parents do?
My parents were both psychologists. My mother was a psychiatric social worker and psychologist. My father was a psychoanalyst. And they really wanted me to go into psychology. And I remember one conversation when my mother came to visit me at college that, you know, I really should consider psychology. And I was just so definitive about biology, and I have no idea where that came from. I mean, I know it was partly, you know, the exciting teaching of Mr. Postleone, who was the 10th grade teacher. Some of it was I had gotten a microscope when I was 12. I saved up my babysitting money for 6 months so I could afford this beautiful old microscope that I still have right here in my office. Hmm. It's an old German microscope, a Leitz microscope from the World War II era. And they thought that it had been used in German hospitals during the war and then somehow made it over here. And there was this microscope warehouse place near where I lived, so I got my first microscope. But other than that, I have no idea where the interest in science came from. It just, you know, that's why I think at some level there's sort of a connection that scientists have with their scholarship that you just can't explain in rational terms.
Now, had you told your high school biology teacher that story about the corn out on Long Island?
No.
So that was...
No, that was completely coincident that it was corn.
Huh.
Yeah. In fact, I'm not sure I ever made the connection there. that's right. He didn't know that. And then I went to... I skipped 2 years of high school, 9th and 12th grade. So I really wanted to go to college instead of going to 12th grade. And my parents said I could do that if I went someplace local so I could live at home and go to college. And so I went to NYU for a year, which was just, you know, about a half an hour from where my parents lived. And one night I was taking a night class in plant development, and I saw Mr. Postiglione in the building. And it was such a great moment that I got to tell him, you know, a few years later, right, what a fabulous influence he had been. And of course, you know, as a teenager in high school, I never thought to tell him that, you know, he was really great. And so we had a wonderful talk. He was taking a course in Italian opera. Turned out he was an opera buff. And so we had a great talk. And that was the last time I talked to him, but I was always glad that I had that chance to tell him that I had now, you know, gotten into a research lab and was a biology major and had big plans to go feed the world up at Cornell the next year.
So you knew, even though you went to NYU for a year, you knew that you were going to go to Cornell as soon as that year was over.
Yeah, I was kind of choosing between Cornell and Yale because both had very strong plant programs, and I really wanted a place that did plant genetics and plant biology. And then it turned out that Yale just wasn't accepting any transfer students, so there was no possibility of going there. And it was much better to go to Cornell anyway, which I didn't realize at first because nobody was sort of advising me on these things, that Cornell is the land-grant college of New York. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the ag side, which is the public side, and there's also a private side. But it's really a pretty fabulous place to go to college because you kind of get the best of all worlds, you know, land-grant, public service, thinking in the agriculture school where I was, but then also, you know, a really fabulous private school for arts and humanities and some of the other sciences. Mm-hmm. So I had an idea I wanted to go to one of those places, and I knew I didn't want to stay at NYU. That was just a stopping point.
So it was a successful experience at Cornell?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've had many opinions on that over the years. Cornell in those days, as was I think true at most Ivy League universities, was incredibly sexist. And it has a pretty long history of both supporting great women's careers and stopping them. And I have a good friend who's a bacterial geneticist in the generation sort of just before me, who was told as an undergraduate in Cornell that women couldn't be geneticists. And, you know, now she's one of the most eminent scientists in the country. And I hope she goes back and tells whoever it was that told her that, you know, what she does now. And I was told that girls couldn't go into international agriculture, which was my interest, of course, because I wanted to feed the world. Most of the women I knew in the College of Ag were told similar kinds of things because we were in a pretty small minority. And then on top of it, the male professors were just predators. They preyed on the young women. And, you know, women would have, they would make their plans together about going to office hours of a professor so that, you know, they'd be safe. Or they'd say, well, don't go to his office hours at the end of the day because his secretary won't be there. Go in the middle of, you know, these ridiculous shenanigans that women had to engage in just to stay safe from the faculty. And over the years, I think it's changed. I mean, I've talked to some of the male faculty who admit that that's the way it was in the 70s and probably into the 80s, and then say that that kind of behavior probably goes on, but it went underground. You know, the men aren't quite as blatant about it because there are sexual harassment laws in New York like every place else. So I guess sometimes I think maybe I'm unforgiving of Cornell because, you know, in that era so many places were like that. It just happened to be that I was at Cornell. So sometimes I think, well, maybe, you know, they have grown like
other universities have grown. But there are two reasons that I think that it was more than just the era. Because I came here to Madison and, you know, I thought I'd gone to heaven. All of a sudden, people talked to me because I was a scientist, not because I was female and short and cute and all the things that they like to refer to me as. And it was just so great to be able to forget all of that and just interact with male faculty about science. And I was taken seriously for the first time in my life and didn't have to worry for my safety and all those things. So that, and that was obviously only a few months later, you know, after I left Cornell. So I don't think the era accounts for all of it. And then I've gone back to Cornell a number of times in the last few years, and it's really quite remarkable how far behind they are on feminist issues. You know, their policies generally seem much, much more archaic and conservative for, you know, issues of women and childbearing and absence, you know, for pregnancy, for being caretakers in families, their tenure guidelines. I mean, it just seems like all of it is back in the 70s, whereas most universities have moved beyond that and tried to change some of the policies and procedures of the university to accommodate women's lives more effectively. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I visited, for example, the microbiology department at Cornell, and I just, in passing, asked what percentage of the faculty at Cornell were women, and he had absolutely no idea. He said, huh, that's an interesting question. I never thought about that before. And that was just a few years ago, and, you know, on the Madison campus, I don't think anybody would say, huh, that's an interesting question, yeah. I never thought about it. They might not know the answer, right. But they would have somehow had the sense that that's something they might have to know sometime,
sure.
Or that it's a question that people might ask. So I think there's just a lack of consciousness at Cornell. So all that having been said, that's sort of the shadow over my 3 years at Cornell. I did have some absolutely fabulous experiences. I had a great research experience as an undergraduate. I TA'd in a couple of different courses. One was actually a speech course. When I went to college, I was absolutely petrified of talking in groups, and I took a course in public speaking as a requirement. Thought I was just going to die, you know, sometime during the course, for sure. And I survived it, and then in the last day of a class, the professor asked me if I would TA the same class the following semester. And I just thought this was completely bizarre, because I thought, you know, I barely managed to survive this experience, let alone teaching it. And that was kind of a turning point. That was, I think, a really important element of growing into a public speaker. Mm-hmm. So I think I had some really special, and then my last summer between Cornell and here, I actually helped TA a biochemistry course, and the professor who taught it actually let me do some of the lectures. And so, you know, as a just graduated undergraduate, I was lecturing in a college biochemistry class. So I got a lot of experiences, yeah, that I think had a long impact. So there are aspects of Cornell that I absolutely love and appreciate, and there are people I, you know, still adore there. But there are some other experiences that I will resent forever, because it was my introduction to the world of science, and I was 17 years old when I went to Cornell. And to have the first experiences being these just sexist, dangerous experiences, it still bothers me that that just went on and was actually, it seems like kind of a collegial joke among the men. And, you know, it's interesting now talking to the male faculty and hearing what they say about that, and they're fully aware of that environment that was created. And so that's kind of disturbing, that it was kind of a joke to them, and it was my growing up.
Yeah, right. How did you react when they told you that you wouldn't be able to go into international agriculture?
I kind of stored away the information. I took a class in international agriculture anyway, so I guess maybe part of me didn't believe them. I think I've always had this defiant attitude of, well, if you tell me I can't do something and I think it's worth doing, you know, I'm going to show you. So I think it probably didn't affect my thinking that much, although I did move very far from international ag or anything applied for graduate school. So my undergrad degree was in agronomy, which was very applied, and it was in agronomy that they told me, you know, girls can't do international work, and it was very much girls. And so I wanted to get out of the real applied side of agriculture because I realized that a lot of the values and attitudes were very, very conservative in that part of science. And my hero, Norman Borlaug, who had bred the short-stalked rice that changed rice growing patterns in the Philippines and, you know, all over the rice growing regions of the world. He got the Nobel Peace Prize for it. He was in an agronomy department, and so, you know, I knew that there could be very important work in agronomy departments, but I was not excited by the work they did. So when I came here to graduate school, I was in the molecular biology program, and I thought I wanted to work on basic plant molecular biology, but then in one of my laboratory rotations, I discovered bacteria and realized that plants were really not very interesting at all compared to bacteria, and they were really just a kind of a vehicle on which you can study bacteria, but that the real secrets of life are in the microbes. So that's what I ended up doing. And, you know, and then I kind of, by the end of graduate school, I think I started finding the right mix of very basic science with applications to agriculture. And so ending up in the plant pathology department was a perfect hybrid. Mm-hmm. And then the international ag issues came back. And no one told me in plant pathology that girls can't do international. This has always been a very international department. We had a number of now retired faculty who set up plant pathology programs in universities in Nigeria and all over Africa. So there was a very long history of very strong ties with other countries. And we've had a very international student body as well in our department. And so people were actually very eager for me to move into international work. And so I kind of stored that information away, but then when the time came to actually plan a career, I discovered that no, at Madison at least, people didn't believe that girls couldn't do international. So, you know, a lot of the negative attitudes that I had heard about women and women in science at Cornell were kind of undone here because I think I had the good fortune to work with a lot of men, both as a graduate student and as a young professor, who really had very egalitarian views of women and were extremely supportive of me in particular, and mm-hmm. I've seen them all be supportive of other women too.
Mm-hmm. That's great to hear.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I always think it's really a good thing that I found Madison after Cornell, because another Cornell-like experience, and I think, you know, I might have turned out quite differently.
Well, how did you choose Wisconsin for your doctorate?
Well, in a very immature and kind of silly way, when I was doing research at Cornell, I worked on the synthesis of proteins in seeds. So as seeds form, they synthesize proteins, and then when the seed goes dormant, that protein just sits there until the seed then has the opportunity to germinate, and then it uses those proteins as stored material for food.
Okay.
And so at the time, storage proteins were a very big area of plant biology. And so I was working in a lab that did storage proteins in soybeans, and particularly understanding how particular amino acids were incorporated into the proteins. And the lab I was working in asked if I wanted to go to a conference on the subject, and so I did. Kind of unusual experience for an undergrad, but I traveled down to Virginia Polytech in Blacksburg, Virginia with them, and just absolutely loved the whole sense of being around all these scientists and hearing all these things, most of which I didn't understand, but, you know, what I did understand I was really excited about. And I heard the talk of one seed protein person from Madison, who worked at that time in the horticulture department here at Madison, and I decided that I wanted to continue working on seed proteins, and I wanted to come to Madison to work with him. So I applied here, and he suggested that I not apply to the horticulture department, which suited me fine, because that sounded a little too much like agronomy based on what I knew from Cornell. And he suggested I apply to molecular biology, and it turned out that one of the requirements in that program was this wonderful series of lab rotations where the students go through about a month in each of three or four labs. And so this professor again said, yeah, I know you're going to join my lab and all that, but you should go through the rotations because it's part of the program and it's a really good experience. And it was. And the first lab that I worked in was one that studied bacterial-plant interactions, and I realized that, you know, bacteria were it for me. And so then I had the difficult job of telling that professor that I wasn't going to work with him, that I changed my mind, and he was just furious. But, you know, people told me this is your life, it's your education, you know, you're going to spend a lot of years doing this, so you better be happy. And he was actually, in those years, just about the only kind of sexist person that I met. So there were also, I think it wasn't conscious at that time, but over the years I was here, I began to realize that he was the only person who kind of had those shades of Cornell, and the lab I eventually joined was, you know, this wonderful guy who didn't care, you know, if you're a man or woman, black or white. I mean, he really was truly color and gender blind, or as much as anyone can be. And so I think that probably colored the decision. It was partly the bacteria, but partly just perceiving a much more female-friendly environment in this other lab. So that's how I chose it, which is really an awful way to choose your graduate school program. But it was one of those accidental things where I just fell into all the right things, even though the decisions were made based on kind of silly parameters.
Then when you received your degree, did you go right into a faculty position?
I did a year of postdoc in the Department of Plant Pathology. And I had kind of had to rush through my PhD because my professor started a company. He was head of Agrocetus, which is one of the big biotech companies at the time. And toward the end of, I guess, my third year, he announced that he was actually closing down his lab and moving entirely to Cetus. And until then, he had been half-time with Agrocetus and the university, and or probably for a year or so. When I first joined the lab, he had no industrial ties. So then, you know, his involvement in Agrocetus became greater, and then he decided to leave. And so I kind of had to finish in four or a little more, maybe 4.5 years. And I never felt like I was fully formed as a scientist, and that I hadn't gotten all of what I needed to get. And I didn't know what all that was, but I knew I hadn't gotten it. And so I always, you know, kind of said very defiantly, I'm going to do the longest postdoc in history. And I got two fellowships, and I was going to activate them back to back and have 2 years on American Cancer Society and then 4 years on NIH, and it was going to be a great 6-year postdoc, and I would learn all those things that I didn't learn in graduate school. And I was 3 months into my postdoc when this job was advertised, and first the chair of the department put the ad in my box and said, you really should apply for that. This, and I said, yeah, you guys, I'm just starting my 6-year postdoc. This is going to be a lot of fun, and there's no way I'm going to be a professor. And then the guy whose lab I was in pulled me aside and said, you know, this is really going to be a perfect job for you. It's phytobacteriology, which is plant bacteriology, the interaction of plants and bacteria. Well, that's what I did. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, you really should apply for it. I said, you know, I'm not done being trained. Why are people telling me to do this? And then this position actually was an unusual one. It was based on these things called, at the time, WRF senior professorships. And what they did was WRF came in and paid for the last 5 years of salary of some senior distinguished professor, and then the department was able to hire a junior person to overlap with them for 5 years. So the guy who was being replaced came to me, and he actually had been on my PhD committee and had all sorts of great things that he taught me. And he came up to my lab one day and said, oh, you really should apply for this job. And I said, Arthur, come on, you know, I'm not old enough for that. And And then the deadline got closer and they saw my name wasn't in. He came up again and he said, you know, you really should apply for this. You don't have to take it, just apply for it. It's a good experience. Okay, so that gave me an out. I said, okay, I can apply for it. You know, I don't have to take it if they offer it to me. And of course, what I've found throughout my life is that once you prepare for something like an interview, you have to want what you're preparing for. It's just one of the, you know, it's just human nature that you can't develop the excitement and energy that you need to get through an interview if you don't have some sense of interest in the position. So, of course, by the time I got through the interview, I thought, why, this really would be great. And then they offered it to me, and I said, as the department chair finished the sentence, I said, okay, I accept. And that's always been my example to my students of how not to negotiate. So I was just, you know, thrilled with it. So I think I stretched out the postdoc to, about a year, mm-hmm. and then I moved, and they had to kind of clear out the lab I was moving into, so I was able to use that as kind of a stalling tactic. And then I moved into my own lab, and there I was, 25 years old, and I was a professor, and I was definitely not ready to do it. But I kind of learned what I needed to learn on the job, and, you know, made it harder, and I don't think I could have done it in the current environment. I think it's just too hard now. You have to kind of hit the ground running and know what you're doing on so many fronts. But, you know, the 80s were a little more forgiving time, and it all kind of worked out. I eventually did learn how to write grants and papers and learn some of the strategies of how you plan a career in science and how you run a lab and how you supervise people and all of that.
Was it a culture that was supportive? Did you have the kind of help that you needed to get through it? When you said that you didn't really do a lot of negotiating, mm-hmm. did that cause you problems in the future, or were you, you know, pretty much able to get what you needed in order to be successful?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I had a lot of people looking out for me, and the department had actually not set up a program for a molecular biologist, which is what I was setting up before. And so they were approaching the graduate school, for example, for startup money, asking for very little. And a professor in another department who was really a wonderful friend to me when I arrived, because he just, you know, automatically gave me as much advice as I would listen to, even without asking. He would just call me up and say, okay, now when you're negotiating, these are the things you have to think about, and when you're setting up your lab, these are the issues. And one of the things he said was, ask for what you really need, not what your department is telling you that they can get from the graduate school. And as a result, the department got the largest startup package from the graduate school that they had ever gotten. It was all of $27,000, which sounds really funny now because, you know, startup packages are more often between $250,000 and $1 million. So things have changed. But the department, kind of their eyes got big when I said I needed $27,000 for incubators and, you know, all these complicated pieces of equipment. And they asked, and they were shocked, but the grad school was very used to packages of this sort for molecular mm-hmm. biologists in other departments, and it was just that this department didn't know, because they hadn't done it. So I got really good advice from people outside the department, and then there were a lot of really supportive faculty members in the department. There were some that weren't so supportive. And I was extremely grateful for the ones who were deeply supportive, because I think I might have been crushed by some of the real negative ones who just, there was no real mentoring in that era. Nobody had a committee that sort of officially helped them through or gave mm-hmm. them advice or read their grants or whatever. And so it was much more haphazard than that. And then there were a couple of people who were just antagonistic. They were just mm-hmm. obnoxious, nasty people. And some of it was because of the fact that I was a woman. Some of it was I was just a junior faculty member and could be picked on. And some of it was they were just like that to everyone. And so the combination, you know, I wasn't very good at sort of the thick skin part of academia in those days. And so that was pretty hard, but my department chair in particular and a couple of other faculty members were just absolutely wonderful at kind of giving me the strength to either ignore or say no or stand up to these difficult people. Mm-hmm. And so my, you know, I'm sure that if I hadn't been so naive and sort of green at the time, I probably could have had an easier time of it. But I was really lucky that I had sort of a few guardian angels who were really dedicated to my career. And I really think that that's one of the reasons, these few really egalitarian, decent, fair-minded men that created the department we have today, because the Department of Plant Pathology is as rich with women as any science department in any discipline I have seen in the entire country. We are one-third women, and when you sit in a senior faculty, full professors meeting, there are usually more women than men present. So, because we have six full professors and one assistant professor.
That's
good. So, you know, I wasn't the first, and we hired quite a few at once, and then we've kept hiring women all the way through, and I think somebody or some group of people back in the 70s, I think, set a tone that made this department different from others. And it doesn't mean that there wasn't, you know, sexism and stupid remarks and insults and all of that. I mean, of course it happened, but it was at such a mild level compared with what I hear and even then heard went on in other departments that I think a few very strong people had really created a climate that is what we're trying to achieve across the university today. Mm-hmm. You know, my work with Wisely, I'm trying to get some of these departments to be where my own department was 21 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about your research when you were able to get funding then? Fairly soon after your, or did you come in with funding? You had funding for the postdoc.
Right, but I had no funding for my lab. Mm-hmm. And so I was really lucky to be on this campus because one of the things we have are training grants, which are given to graduate students. Slots in the training grants are given to graduate students, very often independent of what lab they're in, because they're often given the slot in the training grant before they even join a particular lab. And so there was no kind of prejudice against junior faculty getting these because it was given to the student. And I ended up with three students on training grants in my first, I think within the first year. And that made all the difference in the world because, you know, it meant that I had these really great, bright students funded for 3 years or in some cases more. And I didn't have to get grants to pay them. And I really struggled with the grant writing. Nobody had ever really taught me how to do it, and nobody was really helping. I remember I gave one grant to one colleague in the department, and all he said back was that it was probably too many ideas, which is a really common mistake that, you know, young people make in grant writing. And, you know, now thinking back on it, I know that there had to have been tons of different things that were wrong with it, you know, because I know how naive I was scientifically even. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of all I got. And people were kind. I mean, they wanted to help, but I don't know if they couldn't or if they didn't have the time or if they were afraid of hurting my feelings or something. I'm not sure. So I had a lot of non-successes. And I think that I remember one year I wrote 27 different proposals to, you know, small agencies, private, public, every level. And finally, I started getting some of these very little things, you know, like state funding that would be like $4,000, you know, just bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. And I still hadn't gotten a federal grant. And a colleague of mine who had moved from Madison, from the department where I actually was as a graduate student, to Memphis, had come back to visit, and she asked if we could have lunch while she was here, which I thought was really sweet because she was, you know, very famous, wonderful bacterial geneticist, and I couldn't imagine her wanting to have lunch with me. And she said, "I hear that you're having trouble getting funded, and I was wondering if I can help." And she said, why don't you send me your next grant proposal when, you know, it's still away from, ways from the deadline, and I'll read it the way a reviewer would read it, and I'll write notes in the margin that would be the kinds of things a reviewer would think, so that you get a sense of what they're thinking and what they're confused by, mm-hmm. and how you have to defend against arguments that that you haven't thought of, and that just saying why something will work isn't enough. You have to say why you're not doing it the other way. And she just went through, you know, all these things. I said, okay, that sounds good. So I sent her a grant in November, and I think she must have spent her entire Thanksgiving weekend on this grant, but she sent it back with annotations on every single paragraph, and they were at every level, from clarity of writing to presentation of ideas to the order of ideas to justifying methods, I mean, just the whole thing. And I got that grant funded, and I didn't get a turn down, I think, for like 2 years after that. So I will always credit her with launching my very successful grant writing career. So that's something I try to pass on to others, because it really transformed life.
And you have to teach some of these students how to write.
Oh yeah,
that's
yeah.
One
I think
of
that's
your responsibilities.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest parts of my job is teaching mm-hmm. graduate students to write scientifically.
How was the tenure process?
It was very anxiety provoking, partly because of these few faculty that really like to pick on me and make me feel self-conscious and like I wasn't good enough, and you know, they'd never say anything positive, and they were always ready with the negatives. And one of them was actually on my floor, and so he passed my office, you know, 20 times a day, and would make kind of critical remarks whenever he could. And so I was really tense before the tenure decision was made. And in looking back on it, I gather that everybody was around me was completely relaxed about it. But they, of course, nobody wants to seem relaxed, because they don't want to be taking anything for granted, and they want to make sure they have everything in place. But I thought they did a really outstanding job, in retrospect, putting the document together and, you know, writing a cover letter and all of that. But I didn't feel the positive sense that I probably could have from them. And so it was just agonizing. I mean, I felt just picked over and unappreciated, and I had built this incredible teaching program, and I felt that they were completely lacking in appreciation for it, and all they kept doing was counting publications and saying that, you know, needed more and more and more, and I kept saying, what am I supposed to do? I can't make up the data, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it was horrible, just horrible. But, which is why I will always be in favor of tenure for women, because I think that untenured, for women, I think tenure is a good thing, and I'll always be in favor of it, because I think it's a benefit to women. Because I think that untenured condition is the most uncomfortable position for women to be in, because mm-hmm. men then have so much power over them, and mm-hmm. they have the ultimate power. And so that's why I've always, a lot of women say the tenure system is bad for women. I've never bought that argument, because I just found it absolutely liberating. I could just thumb my nose at these guys that had been making me so miserable for 5 years, and that was just an incredible relief.
Yeah. Would you talk about your teaching, this teaching program that you put together? And I know, and you're doing a lot of work in helping people become better teachers today. If you would just talk about that.
Well, the teaching program in the early years, before I had tenure, started with a non-majors biology course. So I had, you know, a standard set of courses that I taught in my area of expertise. But then I was on this committee that was looking at whether we wanted to build a degree program in agriculture, technology, and society. So a program that would look at the interface between agriculture and the science of agriculture and social issues and how research has an impact on farmers and the whole economic and political side of agriculture and what happens when that economic and political side comes in contact either with the university or with the science, the research itself. And so they had these little grants for starting new courses in the area, and they said, you know, we really need a course in genetically modified organisms, because that was a very hot topic in the 80s, was should we be releasing genetically modified organisms. So I started putting together a course with, they, you know, had this small grant, I got a TA. And we started putting together this course, and I said, you know, genetically modified organisms is a really narrow topic for a course. Let's broaden it to be much more about plants and microbes and society and the interactions among them. And we did, and it became a course called Plants, Parasites, and People, and it's still taught today in the department. It's our most popular high enrollment course. And I just loved it. I loved teaching the non-majors, the young, in the first year, mostly women. For some reason, the Ag Journalism Department sent us 75% of our students that first year, and they were all women. And so, so that was one interesting thing, because of course I'd never taught a course that was dominated by women. And I just loved the students who had, you know, no real knowledge of the basic science, and you could hook them with the social issues and the historical stories, but then you could get them to learn the fundamental biology because they wanted to be able to answer questions about, you know, why did Ireland starve during the Irish potato famine, and you know, what really was going on when the Salem witches were accused of witchcraft. And, you know, so they really have a motivation for learning the science. And that experience taught me an awful lot about how people learn and why they learn. And I have always enjoyed teaching non-scientists about science as a result of that experience. Mm-hmm. It really got me hooked on that kind of teaching. And then in the 90s, I actually collaborated with a friend of mine who's in the English department. She's in the English as a Second Language program. And she told me one day that she was developing a new course for international students where she would be teaching a study skills section attached to a real, you know, content course that they've discovered through many research studies, that you can't really teach people study skills effectively in a vacuum. You have to have it linked to something concrete and in the real context in which they'll use those study skills. So she asked, she said, you know, your course sounds perfect because anybody can take it since it's for non-majors, but it's hard, it's science. Mm-hmm. So we started this wonderful collaboration, and she, of course, was far more steeped in the teaching literature than I was. So I started learning a lot about teaching and learning theory and some of the, you know, the research on what helps people learn and what are the barriers to learning. And we had this just absolutely fabulous collaboration. It was also fun because she, in 10th grade, her high school biology teacher had thrown a crayfish at her. And ever since then, she avoided biology more than anything. She took an astronomy course that she barely made it through in college rather than have to take a biology course. So there was also a satisfaction in her sitting in the course and very much enjoying the biology and finding out that having crayfish thrown at you isn't the only thing that happens in a biology course. And she really learned to love the course. She sat through it, gosh, it must have been like 5 or 6 times, and she claimed to enjoy it all the way through. So that was a really high impact collaboration for me because she would give me, she would reflect back about my teaching to me because she was the perfect student to do that. On the one hand, an extremely experienced and knowledgeable teacher who could analyze the pedagogy, but then she could think like a student trying to learn the biology as well. And so we began to develop the study skills materials. During that course, I then realized that students really needed to be actively engaged in doing science in order to appreciate it. And so I had started a collection of very simple lab experiments that they could do that were totally open-ended. So students could test their own hypotheses, they could design the experiments, they could gather data how they want, and it wasn't these classic cookbook labs where, you know, they have a list of 10 steps that they follow and, you know, they think science is out of a book, not something you create out of ingenuity. And so so I developed a series of these experiments and then finally got a lab section added to the course. And it had to be very cheap because we didn't have any budget for the course at the time. It had to be able to be done in a 50-minute discussion or lab period, so that limited the kinds of labs we could do. And it had to be very safe because we didn't have a real lab room to do it in. We had, for a while, we actually had it in this room, which is, you know, a conference room with carpeting and nice paneling. It was not the place to have bacterial cultures and microscopes, but we did that for a while, and then we got another room, but it wasn't a real lab room. So that was a really interesting set of constraints, but we developed a whole series of these experiments, and then we realized, well, this is something other people could really use. And so we ended up writing a book together, and she wrote the study skills part, and I wrote the lab part, and then we jointly wrote the part about pedagogy, and by then I was well steeped in feminist pedagogy, and so we had a long section on how people learn and how different kinds of people learn and why it's important to have diverse pedagogy in a course. So that was our first book on teaching, and then we also got a grant to develop more of the labs. And then eventually I started realizing that you couldn't really change the culture of teaching without training the TAs to teach differently. So I started training them in the summers to be able to teach in this open-ended, discovery-based, inquiry-based way when these are all TAs who had grown up in a very, for the most part anyway, rigid, teach in a way that they had never experienced as students. And so that was when I started my course on how to teach. Mm-hmm. And then when the Howard Hughes had this call for nominations for the professorships, they started this program in 2002, I think. They were called the HHMI professors, and there were 20 of them that they were going to be giving out. Someone on campus nominated me to be one of the two campus candidates. And so I, you know, I wrote a proposal of what I would do, and it involved teaching other people how to teach, as well as finding ways to get undergraduates engaged in research more effectively. And I got the professorship, and it gave me the kind of platform as well as the funding, because it was $1 million to each of the 20 professors.
Oh, my. So you went from nothing to $1 million.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, $1 million for research isn't uncommon, but for teaching, you know, no one gets $1 million for teaching. And so, of course, with that comes not only, you know, the opportunity to have that kind of resource, but also the burden and expectation of doing something really great. Mm-hmm. And so we were kind of intimidated by it, but also very, very excited. And I have these two amazing staff people who work with me on that project and have from the very beginning. And they're just really, really creative teachers and educators. And so in that program, we developed further a course for training graduate students and postdocs how to teach. And then we wanted to develop a national program for teaching faculty, because we thought if you get young faculty when they just start, before, you know, they have all the ingrained habits and all of the defensiveness that senior faculty have about their teaching methods, you could really begin to make vast, sweeping change in university education. And so that's when there was a group at the National Academy developing some sort of, they didn't know what, but some sort of teaching institute. And somebody who knew about my HHMI program said, you know, we really should kind of join forces here. And we did, and that's where the National Academy Summer Institute came from. And it's been just a wonderful, wonderful experience, just a joy to work on incredibly hard work.
Yeah.
But we think it's really having an impact, so it's really very, very satisfying.
How do people get into the program? They apply?
They apply, uh-huh. Yeah. It's a competitive process. It varies with the year about how competitive it is. It's a lot of it is word of mouth, so sometimes we'll get repeat campuses, so a campus that sent two people 1 year will ask to have more people from that campus trained so that they can build kind of a critical mass.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a whole bunch of different parameters that go into the decision of who to accept. And we look for people who certainly have a record of commitment to teaching. Our favorite is we like teams where we have one junior person and then either a senior professor or senior administrator who can kind of, to use a bad metaphor, kind of run interference for them and mm-hmm. help them still get tenure while doing these weird teaching techniques that, you know, everybody's kind of looking, wondering what is this person doing with themselves in the classroom. And so those are the teams that would get the highest approval scores. And then what else do we look for? We look for people who we think can make change beyond their own program. They can really do something at a campus level as well and train other faculty. And that's gotten much better in our teams over the years, to the point that now many of our teams go back and offer an equivalent institute to what we have offered here for mm-hmm. about a week. Then they go and offer at their own campus. And so it really is starting to have an amplifying effect that, you know, that's being replicated mm-hmm. throughout these universities that send teams. So we're hoping that the Summer Institute will be unnecessary by the end of the next 3 years because we'll have trained so many teams that then go back and train other people that they won't need us anymore.
There are changes on this campus too, right? Mm-hmm. Positive changes.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think this campus has come so far in teaching innovation. And biology has not been uniformly interested or accepting of new approaches or ideas. But of course, you know, it's biology is, I don't know, 700 or 800 faculty members. So,
yeah.
You know, it's a lot of people to all be changing. So it's very uneven. It's not like the chemistry department where, you know, they all know each other, all the chemists are in one place. But I think we can claim some pretty dramatic changes in formats and style of teaching in various parts of the university in biology.
That's great. Let's see. You talked somewhat about your research, particularly when you were working on your PhD. Has your research changed over the years? Has the since you started here as a faculty member, or have you pretty much been concentrating on the same basic issues and problems?
It's evolved a lot, and for a lot of different reasons. Some scientific, that there are methods available today that weren't 20 years ago that enable us to ask questions that I would have liked to answer 20 years ago, but we just didn't have the means to mm-hmm. do so. And then for personal reasons, I for a long time have studied antibiotics in bacteria, and that became a much stronger focus of my program when my mother became ill with bacterial infections. She had an unexplained immunological problem that made her very vulnerable to bacterial infections in her lungs. Mm. And eventually she died in 2001 of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And you know, you can imagine the irony and the tragedy of watching the person I loved more than anything and anyone in the world essentially drowning in bacteria. That's, you know, her lungs were just filling up with bacteria. You know, and these are the very creatures that I spent my life studying.
Oh my.
And the very issue, because antibiotics and antibiotic resistance are the two very big parts of my research. And she was the most, and still is, I guess, the most important force in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I just miss her horribly, but watching her sick all those years, because she was sick for a long time, was just absolutely agonizing, and realizing the extent of the antibiotic crisis, which is just horrible in this country. You know, the pharmaceutical companies have pulled out of antibiotic discovery. The government isn't supporting very much antibiotic discovery, and yet we have pathogens that are resistant to every known antibiotic or every known one except one, and there's very little between us and, you know, fatal infections. And nobody seems to be doing anything about it. There's a lot of discussion, but it, you know, cases like my mother's are not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became more than just a job, so to speak,
yeah.
Became one of my real passions. And so that has become a far more significant part of my work, just because I feel, you know, okay, I didn't find a new antibiotic in time to save my mother, but maybe I'll find one in time to help somebody else. So that's a big force for change. And then my interests have changed, mm-hmm. to some degree. And I worked entirely on plant-microbe interactions when I started. I don't have more than, I think, one graduate student working on plant-microbe interactions now. Everything else is either soil microbial communities or a very simple microbial community that lives inside of caterpillar guts, the caterpillar of the gypsy moth.
Mm.
And there is no other community that we could find that was as simple and easily manipulated and managed as that community. And I used to study the communities that live on plant roots. And that's a very nebulous community, and it's also very complex. It has many hundreds, if not thousands, of members. And it's sort of, where does it start and stop is always an issue. Whereas the gut of the insect, you know, you can lift up that community, and you can change it by feeding the insect. It's a very natural process for altering the community. You can add certain bacteria to it. You can do genetic experiments on it. And you can replicate it far more easily than you can replicate most plant experiences, experiments. And so it became this fabulous model system for us, and we chose it because it enabled us to study bacterial communication within communities in a way we could never do on plants. But it does make me a little bit self-conscious, because my lab is now no longer doing plant pathology. And I mean, I think the soil work certainly has implications for plant pathology, but it's not, you know, directly associated.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the insect work doesn't really relate to plant pathology directly at all.
Now, your lab is in this building, in Russell,
mm-hmm.
Labs.
Yes.
Would you describe it? Is it an adequate facility, an excellent facility?
It's an old facility.
In an older building, too.
Yeah. And one of the problems with these older buildings is that they were built for a science that isn't the science of the 21st century.
Mm.
And so the sizes of the rooms are often not appropriate. The strength of the fume hoods is inadequate for modern safety standards. The ventilation in some rooms is essentially non-existent. You can just go down the list. And so there are experiments we physically can't do, mm-hmm. safely in this building. I've always had a program that was a little bit bigger than most of the programs in the department. And, you know, even though there's a positive reinforcement for getting grants and turning out students and all those things, there's kind of this negative attitude about people who get too big. They're seen as, you know, kind of piggy about space.
No.
So I've always been afraid to ask for more space. And then the last previous department chair did a really wonderful thing. When someone retired, who had the lab next to mine, he basically went to the space committee and said, I think that space should go to Joe. And the space committee looked at it and proposed that to the faculty and made it completely clear that it was his proposal and not mine. I knew nothing about this at first.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really interesting strategy because nobody argued about it. Nobody had a problem. Nobody said I was gluttonous, which is what they said other times when people needed space. So so that was, you know, a really nice addition. And so for the last couple of years, I've tried not to complain about Russell Labs because at least I have physically, you know, in terms of numbers of square feet, more than I used to and pretty much enough, but it's not modern space. And so I've always wanted, kind of longed for just one experience in a truly modern building before I retire.
Is there any plan for that? There's so much building going on this end of campus.
Yeah, well,
not for you yet?
Not for me yet, but there's an interesting opportunity emerging that didn't start as a plan for space, but would turn into that. It turns out that the bacteriology department has been talking for a while, or certain members of it, about asking me to be their chair. And at first I thought this was a crazy idea, and why would I want anything administrative in my life like that? But there are a bunch of really interesting academic reasons, research reasons, feminist reasons, that educational reasons, that I think it could be a really exciting possibility. And if I did become the chair, then I'd be moving into that extremely gorgeous building right across the street, the Microbial Sciences Building.
Okay.
So that's still in flux, but it would be probably one of, you know, give me that chance that I want so badly.
Sure.
To work in what will be, I think, one of the most beautiful buildings. Mm-hmm. For science that we have.
Now, is bacteriology in the College of Ag also?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
In fact, it used to be called agricultural bacteriology about 100 years ago.
Okay. So this would be your first, chair?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, you've been involved in other things, many other organizations and committees, et cetera, on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure off campus too. Would you talk about some of those? Have you been involved in faculty governance or campus-wide committees?
Yeah, I think the committee that really changed my perspective most about the university was the Committee on Women, which I served on for a few years, and then the chair moved to Michigan State, and they asked me to chair it when she left. And I had never chaired a big campus-wide committee or one, you know, that's in the faculty policies and procedures, you know, one of the
mm-hmm.
big official committees
mm-hmm.
that answers to the faculty senate. But I did it naively, not knowing how hard it was to deal with the faculty senate. And we took on some really, really tough issues. And
such as?
Sexual harassment was the big one.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the more charming members of our faculty got up and did a Gilbert and Sullivan skit ridiculing something that I brought to the faculty senate about the sexual harassment training that we were developing. So that was my introduction to just how mean-spirited the mm-hmm. faculty can be and how uncollegial and disrespectful they can be because they simply disagree with their colleagues. We took on gender pay equity, which was analyzed back in 1992, and there were gaps demonstrated that women in certain parts of the university were being paid significantly less than men for the same work. And we did another analysis that made it clear that some of those gaps that had been fixed had reformed. And we developed a mechanism for an ongoing mechanism so that this didn't have to be these, you know, every 5 or 10 year reviews that we hoped would prevent those gaps from developing so that there'd be kind of a constant review of some percentage of women would be reviewed every year to make sure that there was equity in pay. We also worked on climate issues, and that of course is the toughest thing that I think we ever deal with in diversity issues is, you know, we can train people and we can have rules and we can do numbers, but ultimately it's the day-to-day interactions that affect the lives of women and minorities in the positive and negative ways that we know this campus does. And so, so I guess I was still chairing the Committee on Women when this call for proposals from the National Science Foundation was issued to develop these model campuses that would identify the institutional barriers to the success and advancement of women in science. And they were the first, it was the first program to finally articulate that the problem is not the women. And proposals that focused on, in quotes, fixing the women were just thrown in the garbage right away. What they wanted was to say, no, women are quite fine the way they are. What can we do to make our universities more conducive to women's careers? And that was really, I think, enormously progressive. It was such a statement nationally, and it caught so many people's attention. And then the research that came out of these first nine model campuses started to show that, yeah, there are real institutional barriers, and almost every one of the nine programs turned up certain issues. You know, no matter who looked at it or no matter where they were, mm-hmm. they found the same issues. And then, of course, there were others that were more institution specific. But I think there was a power in the sort of collective data that these campuses developed, because it wasn't just one voice saying it. It was many voices saying it. It was and a lot of different approaches to finding the data that supported those points. Mm-hmm. So it was, I think it was a really fabulous program, and that was the program that led to the initiation of WISELY, the Women in Science and Engineering Leadership Institute. So that's been just a wonderfully rewarding program, just fabulous people to work with, and a really strong, aggressive agenda for changing life for women faculty in the sciences. And we discovered extreme support from the campus. And that, I think, has been one of the most rewarding aspects of it, is I expected that we would hit, you know, barrier after barrier and sarcasm like we got in the Faculty Senate, mm-hmm. and you know, demands for more data, no matter how much data we brought. I expected them to say, well, yeah, prove it to me. You know, and of course, with human issues, it's almost impossible to prove anything. And we didn't get that. Hmm. And I expected knee-jerk reactions, negative ones. I expected hostility. I expected people to tune us out and to not come when we did presentations. And we found the opposite. We found, now this was largely among the chancellor, provost, dean, and department chair level people, but at those levels, we were just met with incredible enthusiasm. And that was quite a wonderful surprise, mm-hmm. to feel that the whole campus, and of course that's an exaggeration, wasn't the whole campus, but the people we were dealing with on campus, mm-hmm. were in fact on the same page. And I think that comes largely from the leadership we've had from the chancellor and provost over the last, probably ever since Shalala was here. Mm-hmm. There's been, you know, this long history of support for change and some pretty radical agendas from those offices. So that's been a pretty exciting thing to be part of, but also incredibly time-consuming and exhausting. I developed and ran a training program for search committee chairs to help them understand the prejudices that we all bring to the search process and how we can kind of remove the impact or reduce the impact of those prejudices. And then I developed another program with a large group of people on training department chairs. And I did all of the training of those chairs for about, I think, 2 years. And ultimately, I think I trained like a third or a quarter of the chairs in the university, which is a wonderful experience, particularly if I'm going to be a department chair. Right. It turned out to be useful in ways I never anticipated. But it was emotionally so draining, because these would be small groups of chairs, 4 to 8 chairs, and we discussed really tough issues of climate and attitudes and the way people are treated in departments. And so I finally just became worn out by them, and mm-hmm. I ran what I think is my last group last year, last academic year, because I just
found I just couldn't do it anymore. It, you know, it just took enormous time, but also I would find I'd be just kind of enervated afterwards. So it's been a, you know, Wisely's been a fabulous growing experience and educational experience for me, and very satisfying in terms of the change that I think has occurred on campus, and we have some quantitative as well as qualitative data to support that. But I really feel like it's time to move on to other issues now, and let other people take the leadership in Wisely, and there are lots of great people to do that.
Yeah. Just one question about that. Are there still things on campus that you think need to be changed? I mean, nothing's ever going to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And obviously there have been a lot of positive changes on the campus. But what are some of the things that you would all, what would you like to see happen next? I mean, not you personally.
Yeah. Sure. Well, that's a tough one, because the campus is a mosaic at this point, and I like to think that there are more tiles in that mosaic that are progressive and supportive of women than there were 4 years ago when Wisely started. But there's still a large collection of environments on campus that are just horrific for women. And so one of the things I struggle with that I think the next leadership in Wisely will need to deal with is how do you reach into those pockets of really resistant people who do not want to change and don't believe that they should have to change and believe that this is all somebody else's problem. If they don't like the system, they can just go away. There are plenty of people who want their job, you know, that kind of attitude. And the medical school is really the biggest problem there. And I think working with the new dean in the medical school will be the toughest and most important job Wisely has, because we now have the first woman dean of Cal's College of Ag as of 3 weeks ago. And she's very aggressive on these issues. She's already done things that I've never seen a dean do. You know, contacting department chairs and saying, look, I hear there's a problem with women in your department, and I want to meet with every one of the women in your department, and then I want you to work with me to solve the problem. So she's not going to take no for an answer on these topics. So I think CALS, which has traditionally been one of the more, not my department, of course, but other departments in CALS have been very difficult places for women. Engineering, I think, is great. I think it's really... It's not perfect, certainly, but it's a very, very supportive place for women compared to what it was. Mm-hmm. Now, the numbers are still low, and that always makes it harder to, you know, to be in a very small minority is harder than being in a larger group. But I think engineering is certainly on its way. And, you know, LNS has a lot of women and a very, very aware dean who really works on these issues with enormous vigor and commitment. And the vet school has always been, you know, progressive beyond most of the rest of the campus. And the medical school just remains in the dark ages. And the things that happen there are venal, they're vicious, they are cutthroat. And I have never seen people treated mature, you know, people at the peak of their careers treated as abominably as the women in the medical school. And I told all the chairs in the medical school exactly that. I told them they worked in a snake pit and for women, and they were very mad at me. But, you know, it's like I'm delivering the message. I'm not the creator of it. And just the strength of their reaction and the fury that you know, ensued after I gave this talk to them, convinced me that, you know, everything I've seen really is pervasive, and that they are just perpetuating this ancient, outdated mode of interacting with people. So I think that's the biggest thing in Wisely, is the climate in the medical school and how to finally tackle that seriously. Under the previous dean, it was very hard to get any traction, and I just hope that the new one will make a little bit more of an opportunity for people to make change.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll switch directions here, and if you would talk about the professional organizations to which you belong, the extent of your involvement, are they important to your career, to your research, to your teaching? Why is it that you get involved in these associations?
I think I've had relatively little involvement in professional associations till the last few years, and I think part of it is that I've been caught between fields. So I'm in a plant pathology department, but I'm not trained as a plant pathologist, so I feel a little bit awkward and like a kind of visitor when I go to the American Phytopathological Society meetings, which are the meetings most of the people in my department affiliate with. But I'm really more of a bacteriologist, and I go to the American Society for Microbiology meetings, and that's where I feel scientifically comfortable. But because I'm not in a micro department, I've sort of felt like maybe it's not quite appropriate or something. I'm not sure exactly if I've been worried about my own department's feelings or micro departments. I don't know. But somehow I've felt inhibited about being involved in ASM. Until the last few years, when I've been asked to serve on a number of committees, and they've been absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I've always known that the microbiology field was way ahead of the rest of the country and a lot of the rest of the science in the country, mm-hmm. in a lot of areas, including education and women in science, two things I care a lot about. Mm-hmm. In fact, I wrote an article long, long time ago about how the very first article in the Journal of Bacteriology in 15, very first article in the very first volume is about teaching. And it was by a very famous bacteriologist, and it was about the importance of microbiology education to all students, but particularly to medical students, and how and why we should be thinking about teaching issues. Mm-hmm. And, you know, today, when I wrote that article, you know, I asked a number of colleagues, well, you know, why do you think it would be possible to publish an article about teaching in the Journal of Bacteriology? Oh, and they were just horrified. Oh, that is just, that's a research journal. That is absolutely unacceptable. And they just, you know, brushed me off. Sure. And then in a couple of cases, I gave them a copy of the article. And said, well, there is a tradition there that maybe you don't know about. But microbiology is a very progressive field. And so that's one of the reasons I've just so enjoyed being involved in the education committees. And there's one committee I'm on that does nominations for a mentoring award, which is one of the areas I'm very interested in. So I have felt really comfortable in that community and have really enjoyed involvement. But I think probably what I feel is my most significant involvements in sort of national professional issues have been on a couple of National Academy of Sciences panels. And one is one that I co-chair with a professor from Michigan State on metagenomics, which is a word that my lab coined and a field that we've been very involved in developing. And so they asked us to write a blueprint for the future of metagenomics. And it's sort of like the report that came out in the late 80s that talked about the Human Genome Project and how it should roll out and how it should be funded and all that. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting reading that report now, you know, probably, was it 18 years later, and it all kind of happened the way they said it should. And it's a beautifully written report. Just
that was 18
fabulous.
Years ago?
I think so, oh. Yeah. I think it was 88 or 89. Huh. And so they basically said we want the same kind of thing on metagenomics, because this is an enormous field for the future, and the funding agencies, the scientific community, Congress needs to have a document that says these are the things that need to be done and this is the way they should be done. And so that's just been extraordinarily rewarding. I just love working with that committee and writing the document, and it's going to be interesting to watch it.
When will you
roll
be done?
We hope to get it to review in December, so hopefully it will be out in February. And then the other one is even closer to being done, and that is a committee that Donna Shalala is chairing and I'm on, and that's the National Academy's Committee on Women in Academic Science. And we've written a really hard-hitting, I think somewhat radical report that doesn't just restate what every report from every agency that has done one says, and has some pretty radical recommendations. And that one is going to be, the press conference that, to roll it out will be in about a month. So
well,
that's
pretty
exciting.
I'll have to
watch
for that.
Yeah, that one's going to hit the headlines. Uh-huh. So that should be very interesting.
Would you talk about any honors and awards that you've received?
The one that I guess stands out in my mind is the Cabinet 99 award that the Alumni Association gives out. And I was very, very deeply honored that I received the first of those. It was the inaugural year. And I still don't understand why, because I think there were quite a few people who were far more qualified than I, but I will always be grateful for that, because the award is for making a difference for women in the university community. And Cabinet 99 is a group of women that sort of oversee the university from a women's from women's perspectives. And they're a very activist group, and they're very engaged in the life of the university and in trying to, with small amounts of money, direct the university in ways that would be beneficial to women's careers. And I think, probably associated with the award, was a certain amount of credibility or stature on the issues of women in science that I felt, you know, I had no more to say the day after I got the award, you know, than the day before, but it gave me a platform that was very different, and I'll always be grateful for that, because that, I think, led to my much more campus-wide perspective, and then to the grant that we got from the National Science Foundation for Wisely. And, you know, when you give people awards for things, you force them to identify with those things, even if that wasn't their identity before. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember how much that was my identity before, but I know that the award gave me a visibility in that area that I couldn't escape it even if I wanted to. Not that I wanted to.
Right.
And so I think it sort of anchored and strengthened my commitment in that whole area. It was very influential on my life, and I think that award, they give it out every 2 years, has been very influential on the campus.
You said earlier that you're going to not really walk away from those issues, but it's time for other people to take them up. Where are you going to put your energy? I mean, I realize there's plenty of other things that you're working on, but are there things that you're interested in that you're looking forward to?
Well, when I first thought about decreasing my involvement in Wisely, I thought about how many demands I have nationally for women in science issues. And so I didn't really see it as not working on the issues, but just shifting the focus to more of a national focus.
Right.
And this National Academy report, of course, is perfectly timed, because probably everybody on the committee is going to be inundated with requests for talks about the report.
Right.
And so I think that, as much as I want to do that, and I have mixed feelings about it, you know, I think that opportunity is there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of one shift in focus. Another is I feel like I've just been stretched way too thin. I've been doing, you know, from what I can see, three pretty much full-time jobs.
Yeah.
And so I just look forward to a little more time to focus on my students and research primarily, but also the teaching program. And then this new opportunity has come along with potentially being chair of bacteriology, and that will eat up any time that I might have thought I had free.
Yeah.
But it appeals to me in large part because I feel like I can put into practice in a department the teaching ideas that I've developed and the work I've done with department chairs mm-hmm. through Wisely, mm-hmm. All of the feminist principles that I've tried to teach them. And it's, to me, it's kind of an opportunity to not just be affecting these people piecemeal, you know, at the Summer Institute affecting, you know, 20 people who are doing teaching at 20 different research universities. It's wonderful, it's a great thing to do, but it's not creating an entirely new thing, you know, and mm-hmm. the same with Wisely. It's this mosaic that I was talking about. There are pockets of fabulous environments for women on this campus, and then there are places where it's as bad as it is any place in the world, probably, mm-hmm. To be a woman in science. And it would just be very satisfying at this time in my career to create something that isn't a mosaic, but is driven by all of those values, that mm-hmm. it's driven by approaches to teaching that are aimed at actually working, that are backed up by literature, but also that help women and minorities succeed in science. And it would be really exciting to be a chair who doesn't think about gender and racial equity issues maybe 5% of the time, but has it as a driving force right. in her agenda.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where I see all of the pieces of my career coming mm-hmm. together, mm-hmm. and the only reason that we're still talking about this possibility, because I really never wanted a formal administrative position. I like, and I think this is true of many women I've talked to, I like being kind of the loose cannon leader on campus and mm-hmm. not having a thing or, you know, college or a department that I'm responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
But this suddenly, when they started describing what they wanted in terms of, you know, real revolution in education and diversity, as well as bringing my scientific discipline to their department, because they're really lacking in microbial ecology, it suddenly kind of occurred to me that this might be a playground for me to try these ideas that I've been working on kind of piecemeal and bring them together and see what kind of department can you really create mm-hmm. if you're driven by issues of respect and equity and good teaching and excellence through all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my possible experiment. And if I don't do that, I'll find
you have to keep
something
a,
else.
Yeah, you have to keep a journal if you do it, because it would be very interesting for people to know what happens after those 3 years.
Yeah, it would be very, very exciting.
Well, everything you just said leads up to our last question, life after work. If would you talk about your family, how you balance work and family, and what do you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working? How do you keep your energy level up? How do you stay healthy to do all of these things?
Oh, the ubiquitous question among women. I don't even have good answers to it, because it's not something I feel I'm particularly good at. I just do what I do.
Well, what do you do to stay healthy? I mean, how do you? I mean, that's a question for anybody.
Yeah, that's an easier one.
Yeah.
I exercise. I try to exercise every day. It doesn't happen every day, but it happens most days. I lift weights and either swim or run or do something like that. I think I eat pretty well. I sleep a lot, because I found a long time ago that if I cut back on sleep, it's just counterproductive.
Mm-hmm.
I can't work, and unfortunately I need a lot of sleep, which is a real barrier to getting things done.
Huh.
But I get between 7 and 8 hours every night. And I take whatever time I can have to spend with my husband. And we kind of laugh sometimes about how we can have 2 hours in the middle of a Saturday afternoon and it's like a vacation for us, because we can just so completely divorce ourselves from the rest of the world, from work, from anything. And so I think part of the way we survive, because he has a very demanding job in the chancellor's office, I think the way we survive all of that stress is just to take the moments that we have and really use them, and don't use them for obsessing about work or, you know, dealing with all those other things. That can go on some other time. So mm-hmm. when we have those intimate moments. We just spend them enjoying each other's company, and so I think that's a really big part of rejuvenation for me. Mm-hmm. And then the other big thing that I do, which is probably only a few months a year, but very few months a year, is gardening. In May and June, I put a lot of time and energy into that, mm-hmm. and then it kind of trickles off in July because the heat begins to get to me, and then when fall looks like it's coming, I seem to lose my interest in gardening.
Is it vegetables and flowers?
No, just flowers and plants. I particularly like shade gardening because I think shade gardens are so peaceful and relaxing. Mm-hmm. And I have a fountain that makes a lot of noise in my backyard, and then this deep shade garden with lots of nice. Big leafed hostas, and it's just very, very tranquil. And so I enjoy that garden all year round because mm-hmm. it looks good even in the winter, but I only actively work in it in the first few months of spring. So I think those are the really important elements. And I guess one of the big things I try to do is I try to stay flexible mm-hmm. so that when an opportunity for good family time or husband time or whatever it might be comes up, I just take it. And if that was the time I had intended to spend 3 hours writing a book or a paper or something, that's okay. That's, I just mm-hmm. take those snippets because I figure that I spend so little time really dedicated to family and husband time that any time I can get that time, sure. I probably should take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. And so I think we do really well that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have any more questions, but before we turn the tape off, is there anything that you'd like to say that we haven't had a chance to cover yet?
Well, I guess it's always interesting to think of yourself in a continuum of something. And I think this is just an absolutely fabulous time to be a woman in science. I mean, it's the best time in my lifetime, obviously. It's a lot better than it was 20 years ago. And it's also a great time for my science. Microbiology has undergone this amazing renaissance in the last mm-hmm. few years. So it's just a really exciting time to be a scientist, to be on this campus, to be a woman in science. And I think it'll be really interesting to look back as future generations of women look at this time. I wonder whether it will be seen as the revolution that I think of it as being, or if 20 years from now it will look as archaic and outdated as my years at Cornell look to me today. I don't know. But that's something I'm very interested in this, is that sort of progression of women's experiences. I think that's the only thing I'd add.
Well, that's another good reason why it was so important to have you be able to take the time to do this interview, because I think what you've said in your story is so important.
Isn't
to get it on record,
good.
right,
good.
For the history of the campus.
And that's great.
Really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for doing the project.